Radio Mano Papachango.
Freak bitches. I've always wanted to open that way, stealing that from Rogan. I don't know. Are you freak bitches? What is a freak bitch? Is bitch offensive? I keep going back and forth with that. I'm not sure. So apologies to you if that's offensive. But I don't mean it in an offensive way. I don't know. Is it cultural appropriation for me to think that bitch is like a sexy, sassy, free thinking, I don't give a shit what anyone says kind of woman? Am I being racist there? Because I guess I'm appropriating how bitch is used in black culture. I don't know. It's all very confusing. Welcome to, this is going to be a particularly rambling Roma. It's a rambling Roma coming at you here. I've just got a bunch of sort of random notes, and I keep thinking I could like fold some of these into the intro to the next sort of more conventional episode that's coming up, which is Deborah Kopakin, I forget how she pronounces her name, but I remember it means little Kopeck in Russian. But honestly, I don't want to clutter that episode up with my own nonsense. So, cause she is fucking awesome. That episode will be coming at you in a day or two as soon as I, you know, get around to it. I was going to say get off my ass, but I do this on my ass. So as soon as I get on my ass and get this work done, that'll be coming at you. But I thought in the meantime, I will record this rambling Roma, chaotic, just a bunch of shit that I have been accumulating to talk to you about. To share with you. You know, it's funny. I kept a journal all through my 20s, well into my 30s. It took different forms. Obviously I wrote on notebooks for when I was traveling. And then, you know, as the sort of computer age dawned, I transferred over into various different files. I have one somewhere, maybe it's gone, I don't know. And I remember there is a password, but I don't remember what the password was. So even if I find it at this point, the digitized one, I probably won't even be able to get in there. But the point is that I used to sort of keep a record of my thoughts, and I noticed that I don't do it anymore. But I have a similar kind of, I don't know, what's the word, a cognitive sequence where I think of something and I'm like, oh yeah, I want to, let me, you know, expand on that a little bit. But I bring it to you instead. So you, I need you in a way. If I didn't have this outlet, I guess I would go back to writing in a journal. But it's a strange thing because, you know, I'll have a thought and I'll think, oh, I should talk about that on a podcast. And partly it's for me to sort of expand upon the idea. And, you know, at least there's the fantasy that it's got some value to you. But it's really about community, right? It's about having somebody to talk to. And, yeah, it's strange. It's a strange world. I remember reading in one of his books, Milan Kundera said, I write books because my kids don't listen to me. Or maybe he generalized it. People write books because their kids don't listen to them. I don't have kids. And if I did, they probably wouldn't listen to me. So This is it. This is what you got. This is what I got. I'm going to play a little snippet of a song that confuses me and then talk about it a little bit. You will recognize that song. It's called You Make Love and Fun by Fleetwood Mac from the Rumours album, one of the most successful albums in the history of popular music, recorded in strange conditions. I think there are four major members of the band, and or maybe there are five at that point. I don't remember. But there were two couples, and the two couples were like in bitter divorce proceedings at the time, and like one of them, I think the woman was fucking the other dude in the band, Stevie Nicks, I think, and it was like the most dysfunctional, fucked up commune you can imagine. Like they wouldn't talk with each other; they would go into the recording studio and not even look at each other, and just like do their stuff and then leave, and you know, huff and. Just the most dysfunctional, horrible situation you can imagine, but somehow they created one of the greatest pop albums of all time. But that wasn't what I wanted to talk about. What I wanted to talk about, every time I hear this song, I think, you make love and fun. And then the background, it's all I want to do. You make love and fun. When is loving not fun? I mean, talk about a low bar. You make, and of course, when they say loving, they mean fucking. It's all I want to do. It's not, you know, sit back and write love poetry. She just wants to fuck all the time. And he makes it fun to fuck. Gee, what an accomplishment. I mean, what a horrible commentary on her previous experience, that must be. And yet, it's not totally inaccurate. I mean, if you really talk to women, or listen to women, I should say, dudes, you will hear some amazing stuff. You will hear some really sad observations on how emotionally blocked most men are. I can't tell you how many fucking awesome women that I've been close to who have told me things like, none of the men that I've been with have ever told me I was beautiful. No one's ever said they loved my body. No one's ever complimented me on, you know, the way I make love. Like, how fucking cheap do you need to be to not tell the person that you're with, who's bringing all this richness and beauty and pleasure into your life, that they're great, that they're awesome? It costs nothing. It costs nothing. What are these guys afraid of? That if I let her know how great she is, that she's going to realize that I don't deserve her and she's going to leave me? Well, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you are the kind of guy who thinks that way, then you don't deserve her. It's just mind-blowing how horrible the experience of so many women has been with men. So if you're a young man listening to this, or an old man listening, or any kind of man listening to this who's heterosexual, man, give it up. Give it up to your woman. Tell her how fucking awesome she is. It's free, dude. And the value on her side is incalculable. And you're not lying. I'm not telling you to lie. I'm telling you to just tell the truth. If you're with her, you're with her because she's great, right? Because she makes you happy. Tell her. This is not a Valentine's Day message. Don't tell her with fucking chocolates and flowers. Look in her gut, look in her eyes and tell her she's awesome. All right. Well, that wasn't even on my list of things to talk about. Okay, here's the thing. I've got a note here. It says, community, think globally, act locally. Since I've been talking about this life raft concept and getting a little more specific about it, I've started getting lots of emails from people offering to come to Colorado and help us build. I got one email from a guy saying, hey, it's been a few months, but it was like, hey, I don't have kids. I got some money. Let me send it to you because I'm old and, and he just was like, let me send you, I don't know what it was, $50,000-$60,000 or something. Amazing, beautiful, thank you. I wrote back to him to thank him, but can't accept that. And also, like, this isn't a commune that we're building here. This is more like, some friends who all have the same idea, like, let's get the fuck out of the cities. Let's get to a place where we're more self-sufficient. Let's do it together so that we can share tools and I can borrow your truck to make a run to the dump and you can borrow my chainsaw. And when, you're building a shed or a house or whatever, the five or six of us will all get together and help out and it'll go a lot quicker and a lot faster and it'll be more fun. And then when I'm going to build my place, you guys are going to come over and help me. And, you guys are raising chickens and, I'm growing some weed and, the next person is, taking care of the kids or the dogs or whatever, but it's not like a commune. We'll each have separate property, separate houses, and our lives will intersect as much as we want them to, but it won't be any kind of, strange thing where we pool all our money and free love Quakers or something. But anyway, what I wanted to say about that was that a lot of people are like, hey, I want to come and join you. And I really appreciate that sentiment. And I love the generosity and the open-heartedness of that. But the whole idea is that you do this with people you know. People you trust, people you've got a history with. And so I would be very hesitant to just say, hey, yeah, come on down, because I don't know what kind of obligations I'm establishing there. I don't know what expectations people have. I don't know these people. And so, I really appreciate that sentiment, and I think it's a healthy sentiment and a beautiful sentiment. But on the other hand, please don't be offended that, I don't just say, yeah, come to Colorado and, bring your hammer. I think that the way to do this is if you're feeling that kind of impulse, look at your life, look at your friends, look at the people around you who you already know, who you already have this network established with, and think about how you guys can do something together. Maybe in the part of the world where you already are. You know, not everyone wants to live in high altitude desert. Lots of people want to live in a jungle, or they want to live in, you know, beautiful rolling hills of Wisconsin or something. So the point is, the idea is not, hey, come jump on our lifeboat. The idea is, let's all build lifeboats. You know, and we need lots of lifeboats. We need a network of communities, of people who are taking care of each other. And then, you know, on the larger scale, those communities can share knowledge. And this is already happening, obviously, you know, all over the world. But I think it's a movement that needs to grow, and it's going to grow. And so the more intentional and intelligent and, you know, the more information we can share with each other, the better. Speaking of that, I've been watching, I think I have a note on here about this. If not, it's been in my head. There's some incredible shit on YouTube. I spend way more time staring at YouTube than I probably should, but there is some amazing stuff on there. There's a guy named, I think it's Bush Radical, is his network. And he's just a dude. He's in Michigan. He and his wife, they've got a place in Alaska and some land in Michigan. And, you know, it's these instructional videos where he's like, all right, I'm going to build a little tiny house here, me and my wife. And he just takes you through the process, like from the very beginning. And, you know, you just watch him put together this house. It's, I don't know, it's 300 square feet, something like that, maybe 400. So it's simple. And there's no plumbing. I don't think there's even electrical. I think there's a wood-burning stove. And, you know, it's basically, it's an insulated box. And, but he builds it in like 10 days, just him and his wife swinging a hammer. They get the lumber down at the Home Depot or the Lowe's or whatever. And the whole thing, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful, cozy, you know, whatever, office, art studio, spare bedroom, whatever. And he goes through, I think there are three or four videos. And the last one he goes through and he breaks down exactly what he spent on everything. And it was like $2,500. It's incredible. And, you know, so that's the kind of thing, like, you can do it. If you can move and lift shit and cut things and, you know, do basic math, you can do it. It's pretty cool. Anyway, I think it's Bush Radical is the name of that. And if you don't find that, you know, look around, you will. There are lots of guys, you know, women. His wife also has a channel where she sort of, you know, talks. She does the interior and explains all that. So it's amazing. We're, on one hand, we're more dependent on this very fragile infrastructure, you know, this just-in-time delivery system. So if, like, you know, there's any kind of disruption, everything shuts down and there's no food in the grocery stores. And, you know, it's extremely vulnerable and fragile. And, you know, because of constantly increasing population, we're more and more dependent and vulnerable. But on the other hand, because of the internet, there's this incredible accessibility of knowledge that's just never, it's unprecedented in the history of our species. You know, even when I was a kid, if you wanted to build something like that, what would you do? You go to the library, get some books about, you know, building a thing, or you'd have to, like, find someone to teach you. Or, I mean, now you just fucking dial up a video and watch it, and there it is. It's incredible. There's another one I watched. This guy, I forget his name, he does solar. He's this young, nerdy dude. And, man, he just goes through everything about solar, about electricity, about how to wire it, how to set it up, where you need to buy the stuff, how, what gauge wires. I mean, just everything. Really good teachers too. I mean, it's like Rick Beato does with music. They're, because of the internet now, if you're a good teacher and you have knowledge, suddenly you have an unlimited audience. It's just crazy. And really wonderful. So my advice is to, you know, think about that. Don't look for a leader. Don't look for me to, you know, come and join me. Do it yourself. You be the leader. You, or do something without a leader, but get together, think globally, act locally. All right. Another thing I've been thinking about is a friend of mine who died 2 weeks ago. And it's strange. I don't know. I mean, I guess to a large extent, this is about age. I was going through some photos from 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the other day, because I was looking at an apartment that I and some friends renovated in Barcelona. And I was looking at those photos, and there was a party that we had when we were about half done. There was a photo of these two good friends of mine talking, and they were in the photo, they were in their probably mid-30s, and they're both dead now. And it's like, what the fuck? What the fuck? So anyway, I just want to say a few words about this guy, Diego. His name is Doug. I met him in San Francisco in the early 90s. I had just moved to San Francisco from Barcelona. I was going to grad school. And I was at a party, and somebody was smoking some weed. And I said, hey, you know, where can I buy some weed? I didn't know anybody in the city at that point. And he was like, oh, that guy over there wearing the tie-dye shirt with the hair down to the middle of his back. He looks like the kind of guy who could hook you up with some weed. Anyway, I met Doug, and we became friends. In some ways, quite close friends, in other ways, not, in the sense that, I don't know, he's younger, he was younger than me, and we always had like a big brother, little brother kind of relationship. So it was that kind of friendship. And I call him Diego because I moved back. I went to grad school for a few years in San Francisco and then moved back to Spain. And Doug wanted to come and spend some time in Spain because he had always talked about how he wanted to travel. And Doug was a guy who was always going to do something. All the years I knew Doug, he was going to write a book, but he never wrote a book. Or even an essay. He was a guy who was tortured by, I don't know. His father was an asshole. His father was the kind of guy who, you know, would say, you're fucking stupid. You'll never be anything. You know, just that kind of overbearing shithead father. I met him, so I'm not just telling, you know, reporting what I heard from Doug. I met the guy later. But so he was carrying that weight. And I think, you know, he was one of these people who was very smart and expected a lot from himself and so was constantly disappointed. And it paralyzed him to the point where it was really hard for him to actually try anything because before he even, you know, got off the launch pad, he felt that the rocket was never going to get into orbit anyway, so why bother? He was one of the most paralyzed people I've ever known in that respect. And, you know, he died from brain cancer. He had a tumor 3 years ago. He started having really bad headaches, and next thing you know, chemo and blah, 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 and then he died. And I don't know, I'm no expert on these things. I don't think anyone knows, but I can't help but feel that he's the kind of guy who would get a brain tumor. He was so tortured in a way, and it was all in his head all the time. So he wanted to come to Spain. I was back in Spain. He knew my girlfriend, Peggy, who had been with me in San Francisco. And so he wanted to come to Spain, and we corresponded at that point. There was email. This was probably 95, 96, something like that. And he was really concerned about what kind of visa to get. And I was like, dude, you don't need a visa. Just come. You're Americans come to Europe with no visa. Oh, but I want to work. You can work without a visa. Like, I'd been there for, you know, 6-7 years at that point, off and on. I knew how things worked. And you know, so it was like many of our conversations where he was just overthinking it so much. And I was like, dude, just chill out and just come. Just do it. It'll work out. It'll be fine. Anyway, eventually I get this email from him. He was so fucking uptight. A couple of weeks before he was supposed to come in, he's like, well, listen, I've been thinking about the fact that Spanish people are going to be confused by my name. They're going to think my name is Dog, you know, because Doug and Dog, and they're not going to know how to say it. And I think maybe I should come up with a different name. Like, what should I call myself in Spain? And I was like, dude, are you kidding me? Like, you know, just Douglas, that's fine. You're foreign. It doesn't. Oh, no, I really need another name. It's like, well, you know, call yourself Jesus, you know, Jesus. I don't know. And I'm just like making fun of him. Anyway, he's like, I don't know. Like, I was, you know, in high school, people called me Dougie Fresh. I guess that was like a rapper or something. Should I call myself Dougie Fresh or Dougie? Would Dougie work? And I said, why don't you call yourself Diego Fresco? And I'm joking. I'm like, nobody would ever do that. And he comes to Spain and he starts introducing himself as Diego Fresco. And that's how he was known to all my friends in Barcelona that I introduced him to. They all knew him as Diego Fresco. So he ended up, Peggy and I were splitting up at that point. So I moved out of the apartment that I had been sharing with her. And that's when I moved into the model mansion. Those of you who follow those Tomas or have heard me talk about that time in my life, that's when I moved into the mansion with all the models. And Diego Fresco moved in with Peggy. Shared that apartment with her for, I don't know, a year or 2 years, something like that. Taught English for a while in Barcelona, a couple of years. And, but of course, you know, the whole plan of coming to Spain was that he was going to hang out in Barcelona for a few weeks and then he was going to go travel the world. 3 years later, he was still in Barcelona. But at least he did that, you know, give him credit. He did do that. And then after 3 years, I think he decided, okay, now I'm going to go see the world. He had saved up some money. And he said his first stop, he wanted to go to Sweden because he really liked blondes. And he was expecting to hook up with lots of Swedish women. But of course, Sweden is insanely expensive. Like, that's not how you begin a trip around the world. But anyway, so he said, okay, first I'm going to go to southern Spain, you know, see Andalusia, and then I'm going to go to Sweden, and then I'm going to go to India, Nepal, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so he leaves Barcelona, goes to Andalusia, meets a guy in Malaga who has an English school in the Canary Islands on this little island called Fuerteventura, which is like a chunk of the Sahara Desert plopped down in the ocean. And this guy offers Diego a teaching job there. So Diego flies to Fuerteventura and he ends up staying there for like 8 years. So he got, you know, whatever. And he had a kind of a life there. I mean, it's a small island. And we stayed in touch. I never went to visit him when he was on Fuerteventura. I did go to that island later after he left, but I never went. But he came to Barcelona to visit occasionally. Yeah, he had me and lots of other friends from his 3 years there. And yeah, and then he eventually did get to India. He went to, I forget the name of the city in the south where there's like a big ashram, and he went and did some meditation courses. He didn't really do much backpacking around Asia, as I remember. But then he was back in Barcelona, and I remember we were going to play poker and we were talking and he was like, okay, I think I'm going to go to Dubai, or maybe it was Saudi Arabia, to teach English. And I was like, dude, why would you go there? Like, what a horrible place to go. And he's like, yeah, they pay lots of money. And I was like, yeah, but you're Jewish. Like, you're going to go to the middle, you know, like the heart of darkness of like radical Islam. He's like, yeah, I don't know, but I don't know, where else should I go? What else should I do? And I had a friend who had taught English in Korea previously. And he liked Korea. And I said, well, you know, you could go to Korea. I hear there are lots of jobs there and they pay pretty well. Anyway. So next thing I know, Diego's in Korea. And he got a job and he lived there for 5-6 years or something when the headaches hit. And now he's gone. I don't know what the moral to that story is. But he was like a little brother to me, and I'm glad that he did live his life to the point that he did. But I remember one of the last exchanges we had was, I think it was a Facebook messaging or something. And he was saying, hey man, you know, would you be willing to give me some advice on, you know, I need some writing tips. Like, I don't know if I should, you know, if I should try to write like 3 hours a day, or if I should try to get down 1,000 words a day, like what's the better technique in your opinion? Do you think I should, like, should I write in the morning, or should I just write when I'm feeling it? Or, you know, should I set aside like 8 hours on the weekend? Or, and I remember saying to him, like, dude, you've been talking about writing and describing yourself as a writer since I met you, which is, you know, 20 years, 25 years, whatever it was at that point. And yet I've never seen anything that you've written. And this isn't to shame you. This is to say that there is no shame in not being a writer. I've written, at that point I had written and published Sex at Dawn, and like, I feel weird calling myself a writer. There's all this mystique around, like, I'm a writer. Oh, she's a writer. Like, as if you're some sort of like, you know, you connect to some magical realm or something. And there's nothing wrong with just saying, yeah, I'm not a writer. And I think he was so consumed, like he had allowed that to become a central part of his identity, even though it wasn't him. Right? Like he wasn't a writer, someone who writes. Like I started off with saying, like, when I was traveling, I wrote all the time. I wrote in a journal. Half of those journals are lost now, but I wrote. I needed to. Partly it was just to keep myself company because I was sitting alone in some cafe in Nepal. And so it gave me some kind of community in a way. I was speaking to my future self. And that was an integral part of my consciousness. I wasn't doing it because I wanted to be a writer. In fact, I was kind of repulsed by the idea of being a writer. I was doing it because it's just what I did. It's just the way I processed. And he didn't process that way. And that's fine. That's fucking fine, you know? But the problem is, the longer you stick to this false identity or inappropriate or it's not inappropriate. It's like, you know, you're wearing shoes that don't fit you. They're going to fuck up your feet. And the longer you wear them, the more fucked up your feet get. And in his case, it's like if he had let go of that, look, I'm a writer. I just haven't written anything yet. That debilitated him. And so I guess my point is that the first step, the very first step in discovering who you are, discovering what your true path is in life, is having the courage to say the path I'm on isn't right. This isn't me. And that does take courage because it means admitting that you've been wrong, admitting that you've misinformed people. But you need to give yourself a break because sometimes you don't know that you're on the wrong path until you get to the top of the hill and see from that perspective, like, oh shit, I'm going the wrong direction here. There's no way you could have known that when you were down the hill. You need to get to where you are right now before you can see that. And the fact that you told people you were going this way and you were this kind of person and you were on this kind of path, don't let that stop you. Don't let that prevent you from recalibrating and saying, hey, I was wrong. That's what you got to do. This song is a song that always reminded me of my dear friend Diego Fresco. It's by Colin Hay, and it's called Waiting for My Real Life to Begin.
Checking the horizon, and I'll stand on the bow and feel the waves come crashing down,
I heard Colin A. perform that song live once in Portland and in the chatter before he played the song, he said, This is one of the saddest songs I've ever written, but for some reason, it's a song that I hear lots of people play at their weddings, which is just incredible evidence that people don't listen to the words, you know? They see the title, Waiting for My Real Life to Begin. They say, that's you, baby. As soon as we get married, that's when our real life begins. But they don't listen to the words. It's a song about a life that never did begin. So I've been watching the NFL playoffs, which I have a strange relationship with American football. I don't give a fuck. I don't care who wins. I have no allegiance with teams. But in fact, it kind of repulses me how violent it is, the concussions, the people being carted off the field, the constant lists of, you know, people who are in injured reserve and, you know, his ankle's fucked up, his shoulder's fucked up, his neck's fucked up, he's got concussions, he's, you know, it's just like, it's this gladiatorial thing, you know, most of the players are black and young and expendable, you know, like in the army, and so there's a lot about it that I don't like. But I grew up watching it. I used to watch with my dad on Sundays. My dad played football in high school and college, so he liked it. I never played organized football. Having grown up with it, it's something that I can watch and it absorbs. It absorbs a certain part of my conscious attention in a way that's very relaxing. It kind of reminds me of riding a motorcycle. There's like a, there are things that occupy your attention when you're on a motorcycle, even if you're, you know, like I was quite comfortable and familiar. Still, there's enough going on that you're paying attention, and that focus allows another part of your brain to be really free and relaxed. And so, yeah, there's something about watching football that relaxes me. It takes my mind off, you know, the collapse of Western civilization and things like that. And but it's interesting because it's also the only time that I'm exposed to commercials. I don't have a TV. I haven't had a TV for, you know, ever as an adult. So I watch on the computer and I can fast forward through the commercials. I let it record and then I just zip through the commercials. But I do see them. They come on. Sometimes I'm doing something else and I can't get to the button to fast forward through it. And so those voices come into the room. They come into my head. Some of those images sneak through. And I'm telling you, it is toxic poison. It is horrible. The smiling, fake-ass, disingenuous, insincere, pretending to be my friend, trying to amuse me so that I'll buy this shit. It is so fucking horrible. And I used to go and watch football with my dad on Sundays, you know, when he was old. I'm talking about 3-4 years ago. And he wouldn't fast forward through the commercials or even mute the fucking TV because it was too much trouble for him to find the remote. But of course, he had to have the remote because it was his house and, you know. When you're used to it, like a lot of you listening to me right now, commercials are just part of your life, right? The TV's on, the kids are watching TV, the wife's watching, you're watching, whatever, and the commercials come and you just sort of like, like half tune them out, but they get into you and they shape your world. And I'm telling you, as someone, you know, it's like when people say, you know, when they cut sugar out of their diet and then they eat a donut and it's like, holy fuck, how did I ever eat this? This is so sweet. This is so fucking sweet, so horribly sweet. And yet when you get used to it, you don't notice it. And so you take that poison into your body and it's like, yeah, whatever, I'll have another donut, sure. And that's what we do with our consciousness. We allow that shit in, we get used to it, and we lose the sensitivity to how toxic it is. So I'm looking for ways to mitigate the damage, obviously, you know, talking about the whole lifeboat concept, but also in smaller ways, you know, maybe you can't like just drop everything and, you know, move to the countryside and start raising chickens, but you can do small things. And one of the things I would deeply encourage you to do is find a way to eliminate, to defend yourself against those assaults on your consciousness. You know, record the show you want to watch and zip and fast forward through the commercials, or, you know, pay for a subscription in Netflix and just watch shit on Netflix and don't watch commercials. It's like whatever you can do to eliminate commercials, I would highly recommend it. I would say that's like as probably as important for your mental health as, you know, working out or having a good diet or whatever. It's that shit is toxic. You know, and other ways we can take control, because I think it's so important. There's lots of research showing that a sense of control actually has hugely beneficial effects on our immune response and on our general health. And we live in a time where so many of us are feeling deeply out of control. Things are out of control. You know, as I record this, it's Saturday, January 17th. There are 25,000 National Guard troops in Washington, D.C. State capitals are under lockdown. We're expecting bombs to go off, people to be shot. The shit is hitting the fan. It's out of our control. We don't know what's going on. The fucking ice caps are melting. Methane's bubbling up from the fucking formerly frozen seabeds. Shit is out of our control. No doubt about it. So that is very difficult to deal with. It's going to make you sick. So in order to mitigate that, we need to find structures of control within our own lives. Again, think globally, act locally. Be aware of the massive problems, but take action at the level where you can, which is for you personally, for the people around you, for your community. I have a friend who's doing an online course right now of tea ceremony, and she finds it incredibly relaxing. So for an hour and a half every morning, she goes through this sequence of movements and focuses her mind and thinks about things and in a certain way, and it makes her whole day better. You know, I mean, it's like me watching football. It gives me some relaxation, and we all need it right now. You know, movement. I've been walking a few miles every day. Listen to podcasts, walk. I'm out in nature, breathing fresh air. It's a small thing, but it's important. I think I mentioned in a previous episode, I decided not to drink any alcohol in January, at least. And I haven't, and I've lost 7 pounds so far. It's fucking awesome. Just these little gestures of control are really important. So I'd encourage you to think about what you can do to give yourself some feeling that, okay, in the midst of this chaos, I'm in a shitstorm, but I've got an umbrella, you know? There's a word that I came across. apophenia, which is defined as the tendency to see connections between random things. And, you know, I do this all the time. In fact, some people have said it's like my biggest talent is metaphor. And metaphor is, I guess, a form of apophenia. And in some ways, the more disconnected the metaphor is from what it is you're describing, the more striking and amusing and interesting, right? An umbrella in a shitstorm, you know, that's what does that have to do with, a tea ceremony in a revolutionary political moment? It's kind of, okay, I can see the connection, but it's definitely kind of random. But it's also very dangerous because we tend to see these things, these connections, seeming connections between random things, either in early stages of schizophrenia. It's a sort of an alarm bell for psychiatrists when people are like, no, I saw, you know, all these license plates, they all ended in 7, you know, like it's the God talking to me. But it's also a reaction to stress. And as we're more and more stressed, we tend to see more and more of these connections, which of course brings me to as so many things do, to what's going on politically. How is it possible that millions of Americans think that, you know, the Democratic Party is made of cannibalistic pedophiles? I have no problem agreeing that, you know, mainstream American politicians kill children, but they do it with drones in Somalia, yo. They're not fucking them and eating them. They're bombing random wedding parties in Yemen or, taking out convoys in Afghanistan because somebody that they think is a terrorist mastermind was in one of those cars and they don't give a shit that the other cars are full of, you know, women and children. I'm not saying politicians aren't capable of evil, but the type of evil and the manifestation or behavior that people are talking about is ridiculous. And I think that the way we get there is that these people are under so much stress that their brains are primed to see connections that don't exist, and they are highly resistant to any evidence that undermines that sense of harmony that they get from seeing those connections, right? We want to see patterns in the world because patterns are reassuring. Patterns are meaningful. Patterns are sense. And nonsense is confusing and stressful and, it's very hard to look at a television. They don't even do this anymore. But when I was a kid, if you went to a channel that didn't have any programming on it, it was white noise, it's called, which is just like all this like just random white and black and gray. I mean, you've all seen the image. But you can't just sit there and stare at that. It'll blow your mind. And I think that's what it feels like for a lot of people right now. Like the world is full of white noise, and so they need to see shapes and patterns. And, you know, whether it's the face of Jesus in a taco or it's, intergalactic child molesters, they need to see, they need to find meaning. I saw a guy on the news, I forget where he was. He was, you know, at some rally, and he was dressed in camo. He had a gun. And he was like, and the news person was like, so why are you here and why are you armed? And he was like, well, because the, you know, the Democrats are going to, you know, they attack children and I'm here to protect the children from Democrats. And I looked at that guy and I thought like, okay, first of all, this is not a very smart dude. But that's not his fault, right? I mean, average is – there's always going to be an average. There's an average height. There's an average weight. There's an average you know, I can't run fast. If you line up 100 people and we all run a 100-yard dash, I'm probably going to be in the bottom third. Even though I have long legs and I'm relatively fit, I'm just not a fast runner. And, you know, that's not my fault. And it's not this guy's fault that if you line up 100 people and say, you know, solve this intellectual problem, he's going to be in the bottom third. So, you know, laughing or condemning people for being less intelligent than the average. There's no sense in that. And I also saw decency in his eyes. And I think he really believed that Democrats were dangerous to children. And he understood that children should be protected. And that's what he was doing. And how do you blame someone for believing what their friends and family and their president and their senator and their congressperson, those are legitimate people, supposedly, you know, the political leaders. And if your community believes this stuff, well, how do we expect him to think his way out of that box? So I think that what we need to do is when we're interacting with these people, what we need to do is we need to find agreement with them. Agreement with them is the bridge. And once you get that bridge established, then maybe you can accompany them across the bridge. So, for example, if I were talking with this guy, if I met this guy on a bus or something, and I would try to focus on the fact that this is a good guy, a good man who wants to protect children. I think that's the only way we're going to get out of this, is to recognize that most of these people, they don't have the intellectual capacity or the critical thinking capacity to work this stuff out for themselves. They're going to follow a leader, some leader. And maybe you can be the leader. Maybe you can say to this person, whoever it is, you're right, man, kids need protection. And you're a big, strong dude. It's a good thing that they have you on their side. Because if you just say, you're a fucking idiot, man. Democrats aren't killing kids. There's nothing there. There's no, he's not going to listen to you because you've just said the sun doesn't rise in the east. It doesn't set in the west. Snow isn't cold. Fire's not hot. It's, you know, that fundamental disconnect from what he considers to be reality disqualifies you as a legitimate voice. I met a guy yesterday, actually. I was helping some guys move this thing in town and, you know, they were like, hey, thanks for helping. Like, yeah, yeah. And the guy's like, the first thing he says is, yeah, you notice now that they got the inauguration set, suddenly they want to open up the economy again, you know, and I was just like, yeah. I didn't want to talk with this guy. I didn't know this guy. And then he drove away and I saw he had a big QAnon decal on his car. The guy wasn't smart, obviously. And also, why is that the first thing you say to me? Why is that the first thing you say to anyone? It's not about convincing. It's not about sharing information. It's about discovering, are you in my tribe or not? It's like a secret handshake. And, you know, I've noticed it in my social media feeds. I get these people who are like, yeah, used to be cool, and now you've sold out to Big Pharma. Or, you know, every time I post anything that's like political, or you know, I get people who like five paragraphs on Instagram about how wrong I am, or I get these emails that I'm not intellectually honest because I don't, you know, read the 15 links and watch all these YouTube videos that people are sending me. My point is that if you feel a deep need to proselytize this information, to tell people about these beliefs and convince them, and their lack of agreement with you offends you, then there's something wrong with you. And there's something wrong, because if you're confident in your beliefs, you don't really need that everyone agrees with you. You can just sit back and be like, okay, well, you know, you don't believe in Jesus, but, you know, I feel the presence of Jesus in my life. Whatever, dude. But if you're like, no, you must accept Jesus, then you got a problem. Anyway, the point was that I think we need to try to find common ground. And the common ground is not going to be, yeah, the Democratic Party is full of, you know, pedophile, child rapist, cannibals. That's never going to be the common ground. But the common ground can be children deserve our protection. Children deserve our respect. Yeah, there we can go. Last thing I want to say on that line is Dan Carlin, who does the, what's his podcast? The history podcast, Hardcore History. Amazing. Really cool guy. He has another podcast called Common Sense, which is very sporadic. He might put out an episode every 3 or 4 months. He just put one out about storming the Capitol and where we are right now. So if you're interested in a sort of large-scale historical context for what's happening right now, where we are, the United States as a culture, I highly recommend that. Here's a song, maybe a little sappy, I don't know. It's Nelly. And he samples Spandau Ballet. You'll recognize it right away. The song's about finding common ground. It's about understanding each other and compassion for each other. Yeah, I've got space in my heart for a sappy song that has that kind of a message. Anyway, this is Nelly. The song is, They Say.
Yeah, let's go. Look at you, I ain't seen you since prom. Come to think about it, can't believe it's been that long. I heard your man locked down now. How long he gone? Oh, that long. How the hell he get time like that? 3 strikes with possession. Oh, he ain't coming back. He left you with 2 kids and bills all around. Plus you found out he had another chick cross town. It's always the dog right before the sunrise. And you gotta stay strong for the kids and they eyes. And please don't despise. And go against all brothers and have a hatred in your heart and take it out on another. I hate to sound too pockish, little mama, but keep your your head up, but you gon' make it, I promise. You keep your head up, and that that don't kill you only makes you stronger. And the will to succeed only feed the hunger. For real,
for real, for real.
Hey,
oh,
and they say, past with his sign, we'll work for food, clothes, or cash. And he asked if he could pump my gas, so I let him clean the windshield and throw out the trash, so I let him. Hey, I even asked the brother his name, where he was from, got kids, man, and what's they ages. He kinda stirred for a second, he kinda looked surprised that anyone would even take an interest in his life. He said, young brother, them the only words I done heard in the last year. There wasn't no one, get the fuck away from her. How can something so simple as general conversation mean much more than general conversation? Hey, you could tell life had beaten him down, like he was in a title fight and this might be his last round. Sometimes the easiest things we take for granted until they gone, and realize we even had it. For real, for real, for real. Hey,
oh,
and they say,
oh,
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 yeah. Hey,
oh,
and they say,
oh,
I used to think that life had a plan for me until I realized life had to be planned by me. See, that's the key. I only deal with what I can see, cause over history, mystery brought us nothing but misery. And more people than died in the name of the Lord than in any natural disaster, disease, or gang wars. Before guns, they were swords, and they was killing each other. Ain't much changed to this day. We still killing each other, killing my brother while another mother cries for help. Man, we need to help a brother find himself, feed him life. One, two, three. Hey, that's something her brother should see. And that's for real, and that's for real, and that's for real. Hey,
oh,
and they say,
oh,
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 yeah. Hey,
oh,
and they say,
that was Nelly, and they say, you know, I used to think that someday if I have a motorcycle accident that's bad enough that I'm in a hospital bed for 6 months, but I'm not dead, I'm going to catch up on all these books I've wanted to read and movies I've wanted to see. And it's weird. There was always this like, yeah, someday I'll be stuck in bed. I'll do it then. Luckily, I never had that motorcycle accident. Not yet anyway. And but I kind of feel like that's where a lot of us are right now. We're stuck in houses. We're bored. We're restless. You know, we're afraid to interact with people in person. The fucking virus is going nuts, in, at least in the United States. If you're in New Zealand, congratulations to you. I guess Australia is doing pretty well too, but not in the land of the free. Land of the free, we got some issues. But anyway, if you're stuck at home, another technique for taking control of your life is use this opportunity to do something that you wouldn't be able to do in normal times. You know, read those books you've always wanted to read. Watch those films you've always wanted to watch. If you're into movies, I discovered a channel on YouTube. I told you I've been spending a lot of time on YouTube. That is really good. It's like Rick Beato, what he does with music, this guy does with film. It's called, the YouTube channel is called Like Stories of Old. I don't really understand the title, but that's the name of the channel, Like Stories of Old. I've watched two. They're like 20, 30 minutes. The ones I watched are 20, 30 minutes, something like that. Sort of summaries of the work of particular directors. I've noticed that he also looks at particular films or themes in films, like the anti-war film, for example, sort of genres. But anyway, the two that I've looked at are the summaries of the career of Werner Herzog and Terrence Malick, who are two of my favorite filmmakers. And man, it really made me want to go back and rewatch some of the films that I have seen, or watch films I haven't seen by those guys. They're amazing. If you're not familiar with either of them, I highly recommend this as a great introduction to their work. They're both geniuses and just very unusual, very individual, unique intelligences. But anyway, that's a really good YouTube channel, Like Stories of Old. All right. And the last thing I wanted to talk to you about is I've been thinking about ways that I can sort of do what I just recommended that you do, ways that I can take advantage of this situation and bring some value to you, those of you who are stuck somewhere and are for whatever reason allow me into your world, into your life once or twice a week. And, I often say that this podcast for me is one of the principal values of it is that the community accrues around it, that people are a certain kind of person is attracted to what I'm doing here. And it's frustrating for me that I get to have relationships and insights into you when you send me an email or that's why I play these snips at the beginning sometimes so you can hear each other, right? And when I'm cruising around in the van, I like to have these get-togethers. So, in Boulder, we'll get together and 40 or 50 people come out. And I think I've mentioned this before. We did a second one in Boulder a year later, and a bunch of the same people came, and they came with each other because they had met a year ago and they were still friends, and they, hike together and hang out, or, they form a relationship. And, it's like, I love that. And I've always loved that before I had a podcast. Like, my favorite thing to do was to introduce people from different parts of my life to one another. And sort of be that hub in a wheel, of weirdos who are totally different. You might be a surgeon in the hospital or a tattoo artist or a street musician, but you all have something in common. And like, I am the overlap of the Venn diagram. And when I bring them together, it's so cool because they're like, oh, I get you. Even though your life's totally different from mine, you're a street musician, I'm a surgeon, but I like you. We speak the same language, I'm always looking for ways to do that with you. So I was talking with some friends about the possibility of setting up a thing, because I get these emails from people who are like, hey, man, I really want to talk with you. I want your opinion on something. I want your insight. Maybe it's a business idea, or it's a relationship problem, or it's a personal problem, or whatever. And they're like, hey, I'll fly to Barcelona. I'll fly wherever you are, whatever. Just like, if we can hang out for an hour. And I always feel awkward about that because, you're going to fly like 10 hours to have a beer with me like that. It's an honor, but it's also like, how can that not be disappointing for you? Like, I'm just this guy. And I have this issue in general with charging people money. I mean, you can even see it like, oh, there's a $2 level. Like, I don't know, I was talking with someone recently and he's like, why do you even have a $2 level on your website? That's stupid. Like, who can't afford $10 a month? If they want, if they want access to that shit, like, anyone can afford it. or, you know, like the difference between $2 and $5 or $10 a month, like there is no difference. So by having the $2 level, all you have is like a bunch of people who will always pay the absolute minimum. And I guess he's right about that. But anyway, the point I was making was that I was thinking, all right, well, maybe I'll just set up a page on my website where it's like, if you think that my attention or my input is really valuable to you, here's a way that you can, you know, we can arrange that. So we set up this page on the website where it's like, okay, you know, fill out this thing. You know, what's the issue? Have you talked to anyone else about it? How long have you had it? Whatever. And I make very clear, like, this is not psychotherapy. This is not going to be 10 sessions or 20 sessions, or we're not going to, you know, have weekly sessions for years. This is like one, maybe two, maybe outside three sessions, depending how complicated the issue is. And basically what I'm offering is I will listen to you, listen to what the issue is, as you describe it, ask you questions to try to get my head around what's going on, and then give you my honest feedback. And that's it. That's not psychotherapy. That's just honest feedback. And so we set up the web thing, and I thought it wasn't live. I thought we were just sort of playing around with the web page, but apparently it was up on the site. But I didn't talk about it in the last episode. I'm still thinking about, do I really want to do this? And, you know, and of course I'm thinking like, okay, well, for, you know, under $500, I'm not going to bother. But it still feels weird to tell someone that, you know, an hour and a half of my time is worth $500. But it is. I mean, it's not because I'm rich. I'm not rich. It's just that like, I'd rather go for a walk. It actually cost $500 for me not to go for a walk, I guess, which is weird. It's like I have the fuck you. I don't mean that aggressively, but, you know, the fuck you money. It's like I've always had fuck you money without having the money. I don't know, just like doing whatever I want to do is worth a lot to me. So, I mean, it takes $500 for me to do this. Anyway, someone saw that before I'd even talked about it, before I thought it even existed. And I got an email from someone saying, yeah, I'd like to talk to you and da, da, da. And I wrote back. I was like, oh, dude, sorry, that wasn't even supposed to be up yet. But we talked a little bit and we ended up doing a Zoom call, and the dude is awesome. Super cool guy. And at least according to him, it was helpful. And again, I feel guilty about it because I really like this guy. And now I'm like, you know, it took $500 to like sit down and talk with somebody, and I actually really enjoyed it. You know, I feel like there's something strange about that. But and he's a business guy, and so he's actually the guy who's like, I don't know why you even have that, you know, the lower tiers. Like, my editors always said this to me, you know, when I was writing, there's like, your audience, you are not your audience. So, you know, you judge what something's worth. You judge the way to say something, or you judge what everyone already knows. And that's not true. And you need to keep in mind that people are looking at things from another perspective, and they're going to make different judgments. They have different needs and different capacities. And $500 might be worth a lot less to someone else than it is to me, for example, you know? So it's like, oh yeah, $500, whatever, it's fine. So anyway, this is all a very long-winded and sort of self-defeating way of saying that this thing is up on my webpage. If you really want my undivided attention for an hour, hour and a half. That's up there. Please don't fly around the world to hang out and have a beer with me. But if you really want to talk to me about something and want my feedback on something, that's up on my webpage. And I'm also thinking of doing something else, which would be a series of online seminars is the way I envision it. I did a Zoom call a couple of weeks ago, and it was really cool. It was fun because, I don't know, there were a dozen people or something, and you know, it did fulfill that thing where people could hear each other and talk to each other and see each other's faces. And so there was that kind of community building aspect to it that I liked. And I was thinking, like, maybe a way to do this would be, I don't know, cap it at 10 people maybe, which I think is a manageable number on a Zoom call so that everyone can talk and has time and we can exchange ideas. More than, I don't know, 10 to 15 seems like maybe that's the sweet spot. I'm not sure. And I was thinking what I'll do is, like, pick a theme. And then people can sign up, and it would be, I'm envisioning it as three sessions in 3 weeks. So, like, you know, Tuesday nights at a certain time for an hour each time. And there, you know, might be like a reading, a short story or an essay or something that we'll read and talk about next week on this issue. And so it kind of like a graduate seminar, and I'm teaching it, but it's much more like I'm leading discussion around this thing. And there might be, you know, a little bit of where I'm going to present some information or present my perspective on something, but a lot of it is as I envision it, is more sort of a group process thing. And, that would be more economically accessible to people. I'm thinking maybe $300 for the whole thing for the three sessions. And I'm thinking different things I could do. For example, I could do something about writing, like a writing workshop. I could do something about relationships, things that I've learned over the years about relationships and women and you know, men, obviously, looking at it from a man's perspective, but I've spent a lot of time thinking about these things. Sexuality, maybe as a separate issue, although obviously there's a lot of overlap with relationship. Meaning, you know, finding career path, a meaningful career path. So those are some things that I'm considering. If you have thoughts on that, feel free to send me an email at thatchrisryan@gmail.com. Whether your thoughts are, yeah, I'd really be down for a writing workshop, or I'd really like to do a sexuality workshop with you, or, you know, another idea, I wish you would talk about, let's do a travel workshop, you know, or whatever. Or you just, you know, you think it's not enough money, you think it's too much money, I don't know, whatever. Your insights are welcome. And I think I've talked about just about everything on my list here. I have a couple other notes that are, I think I might be in the early stages of writing another book. It's like women who are like, oh, I might be pregnant. Like, I'm feeling kind of nauseated in the morning. The way I can tell is that I'm lying there about to go to sleep, and I start getting ideas, and I'm like, fuck, if I don't get up and write down these ideas, I'm going to forget them, and I'm not going to sleep well because I'm going to try to remember them till morning, and I'm going to, like, ruin my night's sleep and lose the ideas probably. So the other night I got up and wrote for a couple hours, and I feel like what I wrote might be the germ of the next book. I'm not really happy about it in a way. In a way, I'm kind of excited. Like, fuck, yeah, okay. Yeah, you know, there's this buzz. Like, I feel it forming. But in another way, like a woman who's had two babies, probably there might be a feeling of like, oh shit, like this is ultimately a good thing, but it's also like, oh man, this is going to be 9 months of discomfort and distortion. And, I don't know. We'll see. It could be a miscarriage. I probably should like find another metaphor, but that one just seems to work so well. All right, I'm going to end this. I've talked for an hour and a half now. God knows if anyone's listening to me. Are you out there? Have you turned this off already? Am I just talking to myself? Hello? Hello? I am going to, for the four of you who are still listening, I'm going to play you out with a tune that I really like. And this is there's a funny little backstory here. I don't normally talk much about my sex life, but I will tell you that, I've had a wonderful sexual life. Way, way better than one would assume. Looking at me, I've never been, you know, what you would call, you know, super good looking dude, or, but I seem to have found some, secret formula somewhere in my 30s, I guess, mid 30s. And, since then, it's like things just work really well. Anyway, that's neither here nor there in a way, but, for a while I had a relationship with two women. I'm still very close to both of them, but it was like a sort of a actual relationship with the two of them. And one night we were hanging out and this song came on, and one of them said, "This song has always reminded me of you, Chris." And the other one was like, "Wow, me too. Yeah, this song is like the essence of Chris." And I was like, "What?" I mean, that's definitely an example of you are not your audience, you know? It's like, I really like this song. I think it's awesome. And I'm really happy that something about this song makes these women think of me, but I have no idea what it is. And so I'll just play it and see if you know what it is. Maybe some of you will hear it and be like, oh yeah, yeah, that's Chris. But I suspect most of you are going to be like me and be like, what the fuck? How is that like Chris? Anyway, the song is called Players Club, and it's by Rappin' Forte. Go figure. Talk to you soon.
Me and my homies, we tied it in the club. We chop a lot of games, how we do it at the Players Club. Jump in the pool or kick it in the tub, cause we keep much ass at the Players Club. I got a hoe named Real DeReal. She got a buddy named SB12. Now you know the deal. We gets freaky in the studio late night. That's why the beats that you hear coming real tight. Something to roll to, something to stroll to. If you's a player in the game, this'll hold you. More money for the bankroll. Stick to the script, don't slip in the 9-4. A lot of fools put salt in the game, to where these women get the notion that they running the game, huh? I run my own and I'm my own self person. No respect make the situation worsen. Feel more HP than Sunnydale. There's a Players Club everywhere you dwell. Lakeview, PH, and Orange Street. A different part of town, a different kind of freak. I just wiggle my toes on a mink rug and press play on remote at the Players Club. Me and my homies, we tied it in the glove. We chop a lot of game, that's how we do it at the Players Club. Jump the pool, we'll keep it in the tub, cause we keep much ass at the Players Club.
More champagne, Mr. Forte.
From day one, I had to get my money right. Me flying from
Frankie J, we took an airplane flight, huh? They wanted to hear rap, I said, I bet. We dropped the beat, I grabbed a mic, and then they wrote a check. A few G's for the pocket, no hesitation. Took a flight back to the Golden State, and shops made orders from a whole new capital. The word was getting out, folk tays out rappable. Don't need a Glock, but I bought one just in case. Sucker try to stop me from pursuing my paper chase. So the chase is on, because it don't stop. I got the beat, I got the rap, you make the Glock pop. So treacherous, and suckers could be swipers on a bad day. By the way, just in case you never heard a rapper forte, I'm on a smooth tip. Never tripping on them suckers, popping off at the lip. I pop the top off the drink, and we can roll some dank, bro. Leave the gat at the house, bring some dominoes. Kick off your shoes, relax and get a body rub. And shoot your Mac and at these women at the Players Club.
Me and my homies, we're tighter than the glove. We chop a lot of game, that's how we do it at the Players Club. We jump the pool, I kick it in the tub.
Can't resist it, but don't get it twisted. VIP, that means the number's not listed. Membership is based on clout and how you carry yourself. Now homie, what you all about? I stack paper and kick it with the OGs. Some got a 9 to 5, some took a lot of keys. You can learn a whole lot from a player. A lot of these players make a damn good rhyme sayer. A lot of people get a misconception and start drifting in the wrong direction. Miss Goody Two Shoe, I'll see you later. I ain't got time, you ain't nothing but a player hater. I'd rather kick it with the crew in Arizona. They chop game like we do in California. Another show, another flow, a new bank account where cash money comes in large amounts. So get your membership but never slip the lane as fast, or else fly have to tap that ass and drop it to the ground and make your knees scrub. It's just an everyday thing at the Players Club.
Me and my homies, we tighter than the glove. We chop a lot of game, that's how we do it in the Players Club. Drop the pool.
I like to send a shout out to all the Players Clubs throughout the world. I know they got a Players Club in Chicago.
Man, what about that one they got in Philly, folks?
You know they got one out there in Atlanta, the way they be chopping it.
You ain't said shit, Detroit, New York, Texas.
Yeah, but we gon' move on down to these Players Clubs closer to home, like Seattle, LA, Bakersfield, San Diego,
PA, V-Town, Richmond, Sacramento.
Yeah, but a special shout goes out to them Players Club right across the water in the Biggity Biggity O.
Yeah, and last but definitely not least, yeah, them Player Clubs they got right there in the San Francisco motherfucking Bay.
Yeah.
Where your Players Club at, folks?
My Players Club right in the heart of Fillmore.
I feel you, boy.
Where yours at, Fly?
Man, on the corner of 3rd Newcomb, right in the heart of HP.